I'm Ryan.
I'm Griff. And this is the eBay for Business podcast, your source for the information and inspiration to help you start, manage, and grow a business on the world's most powerful marketplace. And this is episode 230.
Hello, Griff.
Brian, how are you?
Good.
We don't see each other much.
We don't see each other much.
So I'm working from home mostly. Brian's back and forth the office. He's on the road. He was in the UK. He's going to Ohio next week. He sees sellers.
Yeah, so if you're in the Akron area, come visit Wednesday evening.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so Akron, Ohio.
Is there a venue?
If you go to community.ebay.com, click on the events and look for the Akron tab, and it's got the address there and time and date, so it'll be good.
You'll be there. I won't.
Correct. And Mike Swope is the seller who's the host. You know Mike.
He's been on the show before.
He has, yeah. Wonderful, wonderful man.
I heard maybe Georgia will be there. Did you hear
no,
this?
No, Georgia's not going to be able to make it.
Oh, darn it.
I know. I was bummed because good for others to get out and meet sellers as well.
And to meet Georgia. She's got her own podcast now.
That's true.
Yeah, I'm not going to be able to travel for a while, but maybe sometime later this year, I'll make an event.
Or we'll do some local events. And actually, there's not next week, the following week in San Jose, there's an event. So for any of our San Jose listeners, stop by on Tuesday evening. I think it's going to start around 5 o'clock in the Prune Yard. The regular Bay Area meetup group is having a seller meeting, and it's actually going to be sponsored by List Perfectly. So stop by.
It's not on campus, though. We used to have them on campus. Are we not ready to do that yet?
Not yet. But I think we're getting close to back to hosting, and that'll be something that I'll focus on this year is get those meetings back on campus.
And it's been 3 years since there's been an on-campus.
Yeah. So it'll be nice to start to just go out and see sellers again is invigorating, and then get them back on campus will be wonderful as well.
And once again, where do you go if you want to find the local meetup groups for your city, state, or metro area?
Go to community.ebay.com, and in the menu bar there, you'll see an events tab. Click on the events, and there's eBay events, and then there's a second button in there, which is called seller meetings, and click on the seller meetings, and you can find one near you, or you can request to start one near you.
Maybe you need to start one if there's none near you.
Yes.
If you don't do it, who is going to do it, right?
And you don't have to be all formal. You could just say, I want to have coffee at the local coffee shop on Friday mornings just to talk eBay. It doesn't have to be 40 people with a formal presentation.
And those little meetups, they usually start that way and then they grow over time. So.
Exactly. So exciting.
Brian, I believe we do have some news this week.
We do have some news. Two news items, in fact. The first item is the announcement of the eBay Motors Guaranteed Fit program. As part of the new program, car, truck, and motorcycle parts and accessories listings now have enhanced fitment functionality and returns protections for items that don't fit. An added Fits Your Vehicle checkmark will give buyers more confidence and trust that their purchases will fit their vehicles.
This is cool, but how does it work?
Well, it is pretty cool, Griff. Now, when a buyer searches for a part or accessory using their vehicle details, we'll check their details against the fitment compatibility table in your listings and only show items that fit the buyer's vehicle details. If the buyer purchases an eligible part or accessory indicated by a green Fits Your Vehicle checkmark in the listing, but the part doesn't fit, eBay will cover the return shipping cost.
Really? Wait, but we're taking on a lot of return responsibilities. What with the international shipping returns feature?
Yes. And this is one as well. Well, we're putting it out there that, hey, it's going to fit your vehicle, drive confidence to the buyer. So we want to make sure the buyer has a good experience. And if it doesn't fit, we shouldn't push that burden onto the seller.
Well, that's great.
It's wonderful. There are more details to be found on eBay's Seller Center landing page at www.ebay.com/sellercenter. And if you can't find it there, we did post an announcement on the announcement board this week as well. So you can check it out at the announcements.
That's a big feature that, you know, being able to have that fitment compatibility when you list an item. In fact, we have some emails coming up in another episode, I think next week, that actually ask the question about this.
Oh, good.
We'll reiterate when we do the answer, this new feature.
Maybe we should do one of our service announcements.
You're right. We'll record one next week.
Well, I know you sell a lot on eBay, Griff.
Well, yeah, depends on the time of year, but yeah, I sell some. Sure.
Have you sold 200 or more new items totaling more than $5,000 in a 12 consecutive month period over the last 24 months on our U.S. site?
Brian, that's a very specific question, and I believe I have. Why do you ask?
It is a specific question, but I'm glad that you have, because that makes you a high-volume seller, and as such, you are subject to the new Inform Consumers Act.
Oh, dear.
Good old regulatory stuff.
I knew something like this was coming. Go on.
This new law provides a national standard that ensures a safe online buying experience for consumers while protecting the privacy of individual and small business sellers.
Wonderful. Now, what do I have to do to be in compliance?
All right, calm down. You don't have to do much, actually. If you meet that criteria, eBay will need to collect and verify some identification and contact information.
Wait, that's it? That's all? That seems simple enough. I mean, I think eBay already has loads of contact information on file with eBay, and I have tons of different IDs. Some of them are actually not fake. So instead of my John Wayne ID, I'll just upload one of my driver's license. That's pretty cool.
Or Marion Morrison.
Only you would know this.
Only the older listeners will understand that one. Anyone young, they'll have to go look up John Wayne and Marion Morrison. Keep in mind that the new U.S. law also stipulates that for any seller who reaches an annual total revenue of $20,000, eBay is required to include your name or company name and full physical address in purchase confirmation emails and order details.
Oh, well, okay. I know I sell from my home, and I know a lot of other sellers do too. I'm not sure many sellers are going to want that information public. So, That could be a concern.
It could be, but not to worry. There are some exceptions that allow us to share a partial address with buyers. If you meet the criteria for sharing a partial address with buyers, you'll be able to request an exception prior to the Informed Consumer Act's effective date of June 27th, 2023.
That's coming up. That's only a few months away.
It is.
I'm going to definitely need personally as a seller to learn more about this, and we'll talk about it more in the future on the podcast, but where can we find information on eBay about it?
The information is accessible on the Seller Center landing page. There's a link there to an FAQ page which outlines the new law and how to make sure you, as a seller, are compliant.
And we'll put that link in our summary overview for this episode, episode 230. It's always with the, you know, episode links, so look for it there.
And if you can't wait for that link, then you can, you know, or if you can't find the link, just go to Seller Center and type in Inform Act.
I just got my 1099K, and I did sell more than $20,000 worth of stuff last year. Hooray to me.
And more than 200 items.
Oh, definitely more than 200 items. I had a good year. Sold a lot of stuff. You know, I'm moving. I think we've talked about that. So anything that's extraneous, I'm letting it go. I'm sending it off to the world.
If you want to come over to my house and list some items, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, like I have time for that. Well, Brian, it's time to meet our guests for this week. We have two guests. And as anyone who's clicked on this episode knows, the topic of this next segment is debunking listing myths. If you spend any time online or in eBay forums and you're with a bunch of eBay sellers, you will hear lots of theories, opinions, and advice about what makes a perfect listing and what you should do when you're putting an item listing together to sell something on eBay. And sometimes we hear some pretty good advice, and then other times we hear stuff where those of us who have been at eBay for a long time like shake our heads and go, "What?" There are some myths about listing, and some of them are true and some of them aren't. And in order for us to lead through and discover what's good and what's not so good, we have with us this week Valerie Yee. Valerie has been at eBay for a long time. She works with the seller experience and product team and technology. She's chief of staff for that team, in fact, so she kind of herds everything that's going on over there. And Valerie has brought with us this week a experienced seller named Ashley Mulder. Her eBay store is Millennial Mouse. Welcome, Valerie. Welcome, Ashley.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Valerie, I thought we'd start off with taking a listing apart from top to bottom. What do you think?
Sounds like a good plan.
So, first off, this has been a discussion on the last few episodes, item titles. And I'm curious to see what we say, Valerie, when it comes to the eBay side about putting together the best item title.
So item titles is always a big debate on this, right? And the biggest thing I can say is be careful of keyword stuffing your title. For example, we see listings that have both Android and iPhone in the title. There's not very many things that apply to both of those, especially for selling a case or things like that. So just, you know, be careful and just make sure that it's accurate information. So I always like to say is it can be confusing for the buyer. So just think like a buyer as you're writing your titles and the eBay search engine as well. So I like to say, you know, stick to the facts, Jack.
So unless that particular thing that you're selling is compatible with both iPhone and Android, don't.
Exactly.
And a case is probably not going to fit both. So you want to make sure that you're not using both of those words. I think sellers think, well, that way I'll get twice the audience. What happens in a case like that?
Well, in terms of the buyer, it's confusing, right? The buyer may not click on it because they think, well, I don't know if it applies to my thing or not. So they might not get even to your view item page to look at it.
What else should we be concerned about with an item title?
A lot of people, it's a huge debate also on the order of words. And I consulted with someone in the search ranking team, and they provided guidance that the title should be written as if you're saying it to someone. So I always like to say an example is you wouldn't say loft, plaid, blouse, women's size, medium, black, white, red, long sleeve, polyester. Like you wouldn't say that to your friend if you're out shopping. Start with the brand of Ann Taylor, loft, long sleeve, blouse, size, medium, black, white, and red plaid. Something like that.
And that brand's important. If it's a branded piece of apparel, put the brand first.
Definitely. And then we know it's tricky with the character limit, but you don't need to put the condition in the title. When you shop on eBay yourself, you'll notice that underneath in search and also when you save it in your My eBay watch list, it will say the condition, the item condition, right under the title. So you don't necessarily have to use those characters in your title. You can save them for describing the item.
If you've listened to the last couple episodes of the podcast, we had questions in particular from one seller who sent them in about using extraneous things in the title like apostrophes and emojis and exclamation points and at signs. What kind of advice, Ashley, do you give when you hear this? Or do you hear it? I mean, I'm making the assumption.
I do hear it quite a bit. I think not necessarily extraneous ones. The most common ones I hear are when it applies to the brand name, whether I should use the apostrophe if it applies to the brand name. Common one that I run into, obviously, because of what I sell, is Levi's, of whether you should put the apostrophe in for Levi's. And I know for me, what I did is instead of going through and doing all this, I just did the research myself. I typed in Levi's with the apostrophe, saw how many results I got, typed in Levi's without the apostrophe, saw how many results I got. They were identical. So to me, I just prefer just to leave off the apostrophe automatically so I automatically get that extra character back. But I mean, you can obviously make the choice to do either or if you have that one single extra character if you want to use it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not harmful to use it, obviously. Valerie, what's your take on punctuation in titles? As though I have to ask.
Yeah, exactly. Again, I consulted the search experts on this one because that is a different organization than mine. So we always like work together with our partners around here. And I said, yeah, there's a big myth going around online that something with an apostrophe, it'll affect the search algorithm. And the verdict is with or without the apostrophe, it actually doesn't matter. So just like Ashley said, you can do it with and without. The results are the same in the back end, in search ranking and the algorithm. It's exactly the same. So don't spend time worrying about your punctuation. Save those characters for better things.
I love what Ashley just said, because you can give yourself peace of mind by just researching, do a few searches and see what comes up.
Exactly.
I think a bigger question I probably get is going back to what Valerie was talking about was order of words. I get that more than anything else. And I notice there is a lot of hot takes on the preference of order of words. And so Valerie, I wanted to ask you actually, I know you were saying about having it so that it describes the item like naturally, fluently. However, a lot of times that will come out. So me, I sell a lot of pre-owned fashions, men's, women's, youth, girls, kids, whatever it may be, especially women's, because I feel like that's such a long word. And it's, if you're putting that right in the beginning, it feels repetitive. And so if I'm going to search for something, I guess my question to you is how important is it into like the SEO part of whether it is towards the front of the title or the back of the title? Because I have my theory on it, but I don't know about the search engine side of it.
That's a good question, Valerie.
That's a good question. I'm not sure if it matters from like if women's is first or last. The common example that the search team gives me in terms of order of words is a dress shirt is very different than a shirt dress. And so there is some tokenization they do on the back end where they look at combination of words like that and they do treat them differently. I guess it's think about the phrase and does it maybe equal something else? Like I just said, a dress shirt is very different than a shirt dress. If you're putting women's at the end and it still makes sense, then it's most likely still okay.
Like I said, I do a lot of research on my own. So when I was researching, I went to the app, I put in a couple key search terms for what I was looking for. What I noticed was is where my eyes were going on the screen for the results. If women's was towards the front, I was more likely to look over that item because it wasn't automatically what I was looking for. I know I'm looking for a women's item. I know that already. So to me, I found myself looking past those ones because what I was looking for was not right there in the beginning. So to me, it was more of a visualization thing. So that's why I prefer to do brand, my description kind of it, whether plaid shirt, dress shirt, whatever. And then the category, women's, men's, what have you. And then the size. that's kind of how I fell to that default. But I wanted to make sure, like, if that was okay, because if not, I'm obviously going to go back to the other way.
No, I think it's fine. And I think the other thing to note is that when you are searching, you'll notice that eBay tries to give you pre-filled suggestions. And a lot of those are also category-based. And so a lot of the buyers will notice that something says women's category, women's clothing. And so if they click on that, like, it automatically filters to that category. So in theory, you're right, you shouldn't have to start with women's, because then you're assuming that they're already in the women's category. So that does help also when filtering it down. The buyer makes that choice when they're searching. So that does also help.
The only time I find that to be a little bit annoying, it's not eBay, is when a seller has put a woman's item into the men's category or vice versa, and then it's kind of lost, right? If a buyer is trying to limit their search just to a particular category, because there's a lot of apparel on eBay, your item could be missing. So you got to make sure you put it in the right category.
So one other piece of advice that we like to give is that, just like Ashley was saying, is like, think like a buyer and do some research. And if you're trying to decide which category to put something in, I know an example that's been given to me before is like golfing shirts. And if you're selling a Nike polo golf shirt, like, do you put that under athletic apparel or do you put it under men's apparel, right? And so the suggestion is that you can do a search for that Nike golf shirt and see what eBay recommends as the category. And so if that's where eBay is pushing buyers, then that's where you should probably push your buyers as well.
It's not always easy trying to determine which is going to be the right category. I run into that too myself.
Yeah, I think one of the big ones I run into is whether to list in the vintage category or not. That has to be the most confusing one of them all. I was listing in the vintage category for a while and like pushing it there. And then I noticed a lot of my stuff wasn't getting seen. So I've been now diverting from the vintage category whenever possible, unless it comes up as a suggested category, then I will like go in and research it.
There's an ongoing, I don't want to call it a joke, but I have a real problem with the word vintage. To me, it doesn't mean anything. And I won't get off into a screed here because you can hear it in other episodes, but I'd rather not use it ever. Anyway, enough of that, because then this will become a different show. I have one more thing about item titles that I want to talk about, and that's the item-specific extraction. Valerie, what is that? And how does it relate to titles?
As you're typing in your title, we do try to minimize the clicking work later of choosing your item specifics, and we will try our best to extract the item specifics from the title. There should be a little box under your title that says, hey, like, this is what we've determined they are, and we could be wrong. Like, the biggest example I'd like to give is Victoria's Secret is a brand pink, and it's also a color pink. It can be tricky. There's also Ralph Lauren blue cologne, and that blue is a color, and blue is also a cologne type. The computer algorithms are only as smart as we can make them to be. You know, they're not necessarily perfect because our English language is a little tricky sometimes, and just sort of bear with it. But if it's wrong, just unselect it and don't choose it and go down to the true item specific section and pick what it should be. But we're trying to make it easier for you to list and make it faster.
While we're on the topic of item specific, let's focus in a little bit more on those. Valerie, lots of discussion, and I'm sure Ashley has seen it too, among sellers when they're communicating with each other about item specifics, what you should, what you shouldn't do, how important are they, what benefit do they provide? What's your take when you hear these things, Valerie?
All right. So we have required, and then we used to have what we call recommended. We're trying to change that verbiage to additional now. Required or created with the intention of buyer demand. So this is what buyers are filtering on and searching on. Required should be very few. It should be like 5 or less, and sometimes it's even 3. Those are the ones that are required. Guaranteed, you have to do those ones. They're usually pretty easy. You shouldn't have to do any additional research. But then when you get to the additional ones, like, this is where we try to provide data so you can make an informed decision if you want to take the time to fill that out. We will tell you how many buyers are searching on that. You know, there's a million buyers searching on that. You might want to fill that one out to get a little more eyeballs. But if it's got 500 searches and you really don't know the answer, it's okay to leave it blank. We're trying our best to, we used to have the dial. I know you love the dial. Geez. Don't get started on the dial. We have a lot of people out there that have to complete the dial. You don't have to complete it. It's okay. It's one of those things of, best laid plan kind of went wonky with everyone trying to fill it out.
We don't have that anymore, thankfully.
No, we took away the dial. No more dial. So it's basically additional. And we're trying our best to, because we're trying to provide data for you to make a decision that's good for your business, right?
Exactly.
If you don't want to do it, you don't want to do it. I have one final thing and then I'll pass it off to Ashley. But like, my other myths, I suppose, is everyone's like, well, I'm just going to put NA. Doesn't apply. Please don't do that. Please don't put NA. And the reason why is because this information shows up on the left-hand navigation of search. Would you, as a buyer, ever filter on NA? Probably not. Just think like a buyer. Would a buyer filter on that? Nope. So please don't do it. The other thing I've heard sellers say, which really gets me, is they, especially for character, I know you all love character. It's your favorite item specific out there. I know Ashley's laughing. is that I met a seller once that said, I put Batman for everything. And I was like, please don't do that either, because now you have a buyer that filtered on Batman and your thing does not have Batman. And then I have another seller I know who sells flatware, and he's like, why do I need a character? And I know Ashley isn't a Disney fan like myself. And I said, well, you know, there is forks that have Elsa as a character. Maybe someone's looking for that Elsa fork. And that's why character exists in some places where you think, why in the heck is character in flatware?
To the point, when a seller says that to you, why do I need? And the answer, you don't need. These are the additional item specifics. Only use them if they're relevant. Don't try to gamify this. It's not going to work. Don't pick something if it doesn't relate to the item. If the fork doesn't have a character on it, leave it blank.
So Ashley, what do you hear from your sellers about item specifics?
I'm dying to know.
I'm going to cringe. I'm going to go hide.
Probably the most common is if I fill out more additional specifics, it will make my listing more searchable and rank higher in search. When you're filling out things that don't make sense to the item, for example, we'll go back to character. Big character one that used to happen is blue. The color blue used to pull character a lot. It stopped. I've noticed that. I didn't get it last night while I was listing, thankfully. But a lot of times they will spend all of this time researching these additional specifics extensively just to complete them because they think it's going to help them in search. And I'm like, don't waste your time. I said, my general rule of thumb is if it's automatically populated by the title, I'll leave it there. Or if it's automatically populated by the title but happens to be wrong, I will correct it. Other than that, if when you're looking at the item specifics, it will start to auto-generate some of the items like previews. They're not always the same previews either. If the item shows up there in the previews, I will select it. If the right choice is in the previews, I won't go to the drop-down. My only two exceptions to that, because I do sell a lot of denim, are the denim rise and the denim inseam.
Well, those are important.
Yeah, because those are critical things that you need for that particular item. But people will go through extensively filling out like place of manufacture. So I'm sorry, if an item is not vintage and it's not made in the USA, they do not care where it was manufactured 99% of the time. 99% of the buyers, they don't care. Even then, they're probably still not going to search for it, you know, on the left-hand navigation or in the app or what have you. I think that's probably the biggest myth, and people will spend extensive amount of time where they could have just spent the time listing more or improving their SEO or taking better photos or anything else, quite literally, instead of wasting all your time researching these items specific extensively. It's not necessary.
It wasn't that long ago I had a seller tell me that they called the company and tried to find out where the item was manufactured so they could put it in their item specifics. So
no
they
way.
Spent time on the phone trying to reach the company, find someone who could tell them where it was manufactured. I think in the end they said, you know, we don't know because we don't make those anymore and there's no record.
Wow. So, I mean, yeah, so like, I mean,
that's next level.
That is way next level. Like, for example, I'm selling a Coach wristlet right now. And, you know, one of the additional item specifics is asking for the material of the strap. I have no idea. I don't know if it's leather.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if it's pleather. And I'm certainly not going to guess because I don't want to set myself up for an item not as described defect, right? Because what if I say it's leather and it's not? That is, to me, the worst case scenario. I would much rather leave it blank than get it wrong.
I agree.
Another thing, too, that I think a lot of sellers miss or skip, I should say, maybe because it's not available in the listing version of the app, and this is an item specific, but not really an item specific, is condition description. That is probably the most unused item specific by sellers that I've interacted with. They don't use it. And to me, I'm like, you see it twice on the web page if you're searching on the web. So obviously it's important. And it's one of the few parts of the description that does not collapse on the app, when you're looking at it on the app.
I can tell you a recent story where I had a buyer where I indicated the condition very clearly and the buyer wanted to return the item. It wasn't very expensive. because they said the condition should have been in the title. And I said, well, that's not where it goes. And she said, and I'm paraphrasing, but she said, honey, I've been selling on eBay for 20 years. How long have you been selling? And I didn't answer. It wouldn't be fair. I just said, well, okay. And that was the end of it.
That's a tough one.
I actually had a case open one time and I was able to win the case when I contacted eBay because of my condition and the flaw that she was saying wasn't described was described in the condition description. Because I put the same condition description, I put it in my description and I put it in the condition description. But also too, I don't know why it's not available. If you're listing from the app, it's not an option on the app to fill out the condition description.
Valerie, what's going on back there in product?
I will go ask my team about that one.
Because I don't list from the app, personally. I don't. I only list on the computer. So I was trying to figure out why people weren't using condition description. So I went and tried to list on the app a little bit. I was like, wait, where is it? I dug and dug. I was like, it's not here.
I will go ask my team about that one.
Mea culpa on our end. Sorry
but
about that.
That was a really good point. I'm just going to mention it again, is that you're right. The item condition little text box allows you to give more information, stains, perfect, you know, perfect is always hard because that's subjective, but giving specific facts about what your item condition is, especially if it's pre-owned. And you're right, it shows up by default. So you don't have to click on the show more description in native. That is critical because a lot of sellers say buyers don't read. I got to click on that extra link. And well, if you put it in that little box, then they don't have to click on the extra link because it's already there.
Yeah, that's very good information.
And I actually utilize it too to kind of direct them more to the description. I'll put like, you know, pre-owned, very good condition. Please see description for measurements and further condition details. I have something right now, but on my board is right now.
Yeah, I always say see photos for more details, for example.
Yeah, try and push them to the description.
Like you, I know that's so there, whether they're in the app or on the desktop version, they're going to see that and it'll grab. Or at least I thought with this particular item, this was the seller who turned out to be one of those buyers who doesn't read.
Well, that's fun. I wanted to say one last thing before we move on to the next topic is that I know that many people are frustrated when they do all their item specifics in the listing tool on the computer and then they change the category and then all the item specifics are wiped out. There is a technical reason for that, and that is because there is a very tight relationship between the category and the item specifics. They are super tightly coupled. So if you please, please change the category first. And then it will pre-fill then or have at least show you what are all the required and additional item specifics for that category. And the reason why is each category has their own buyer demand data. And so that's why that sort of happens.
Can I make a suggestion then in the listing tool when you have your title? Well, this is for the web only. Obviously, I don't listen to the app. So you have your title, you have your custom label. And then when you do that, that box that generates all of the, you know, item specifics, it is before the category. So if you had the category first and then that box, which I believe is how it used to be before the new listing tool, because I noticed that while I was listing last night even, you know, I kept trying to remember to change the category, but because that box popped up first, I would click the thing, then I'd go change category and be like, oh. So if it was below, it'd be more natural to change the category first.
There you go, Valerie.
I will
another thing to write down, right?
I know, I got to take notes.
That was part one of our conversation with Valerie Yee and seller Ashley Mulder. We'll continue with part two of the conversation next week on episode 231.
You got questions?
We got answers. And Brian, our first email is from our good friend, Angie Cardona Nelson. Hey, why don't you read it for us?
Sure will. Angie said to us, hello, Griffin Brian. What is the best way to see the number of sales or percentage of international transactions sold? I do GSP, or Global Shipping Program, for all my items. However, now with the new service for international shipping, different hubs or zip codes based on location to seller, etc., how can we sort transactions or filter them, etc.? A couple of years ago, I was able to get a good report from PayPal on international sales. Very visual, very fun. I wonder if eBay will be providing something similar. I love seeing what global sales represent for our business. Thank you very much, Angie Cardona Nelson, and that's Angie's Green Go Surplus.
Thank you, Angie.
Well, Griff, is there a way for Angie to determine which sales were made through eBay International Shipping?
Actually, there is. Angie, I talked to our shipping team, as I always want to do when I don't know the answer, and they told me this about your question. They're working on implementing a filter for eBay international shipping transactions for our sellers so that you can identify and sort them easier. That should be available sometime this year, I believe. In the meantime, Angie, you can always use the information in a transaction report.
And you probably already know how to find the transaction report feature, but for anyone else who doesn't know, it's available under the Payments tab in Seller Hub. If you filter your transaction report by city and look for a city in Illinois called Glendale Heights, those will indicate an eBay International shipping transaction. In a few months, there will be another city along with Glendale Heights to use in the sort, and that city will be Commerce, California.
That's correct. So right now, there's only one international hub outside of GSP, which is still, I think,
in Kentucky.
And that one is in Glendale Heights. So you can sort, you can look for the ship to address. And if the city is Glendale Heights, you can identify those as international shipping transactions. But in the future, sometime, hopefully, as I said, this year, there'll be a flag, a label that'll make it much easier to find and aggregate those. So, Angie, use those cities to find your eBay international shipping transactions in that transaction report for now and look for that specific EIS filter coming sometime, hopefully this year. Now, our next question was sent to podcast@ebay.com by seller Nate, who writes, "Hello to my favorite business podcast hosts." Let's take a moment and drink that in for a second.
We should.
Thanks, Nate. That was very kind. Anyway, Nate says, "I was listening to episode 227 and heard it mentioned that eBay frowns upon using a shipping service different than the buyer selected. Does this only apply to buyer-paid shipping? I offer free shipping on all my listings, and UPS Ground is always the buyer-selected service. However, most of my packages are less than a pound, so I usually select USPS First Class. I'm also wondering if there's a recommended way to set up free shipping on a listing. I have it set up as a flat rate cost type with UPS Ground and USPS First Class as the two domestic services. The offer free shipping toggle is switched on for UPS Ground, and I just have the buyers pay a set zero for First Class." You can address these as two separate questions, Brian. He says, "My eBay username is Hatz, H-A-T-Z, Brands." That's one word. "Thanks for all you do, and keep up the great work." Thank you. Nate Hatz, Hatz Brands. Does he sell hats?
I bet he does. Hatz with a Z.
Yeah, I should go check.
Well, Nate, it's generally okay to select a different class of service from the one the buyer selected, as long as the service has the same delivery time and the shipping was free.
Exactly. With free shipping, the cost of shipping is never a buyer concern. But the delivery speed issue may be one. So although if you selected a class of service that's different from what the buyer selected and it's going to take a lot longer, that could set you up for an unhappy buyer. That's something to think about.
And Nate, depending on the location of the buyer in relation to your location, USPS priority and USPS first class delivery times may, and I say may, be comparable.
Yeah, they can be. I find, at least from shipping from San Jose, that priority mail packages for USPS and first class packages for USPS tend to get to their destinations anywhere in the country for me roughly around the same time. Maybe the first class can be a day late. You can do that. That's up to you. I don't think there's a big risk as long as you make sure you're not delaying the shipping. Otherwise, we don't recommend it.
Yeah, you're right. Otherwise, we don't recommend switching out the service for a shipment, since there may be a good reason why the buyer selected a specific class of service or even a carrier if you provided the choice.
Yeah, if you provided the choice and they selected a specific one. So, for example, somebody who lives in a rural area, UPS delivery may be really difficult, if not impossible. And that's why they selected the USPS delivery, or vice versa. So you got to tread carefully there. Now, as for the free shipping setup question that you asked, Nate, I think your solution is working. It's a little awkward, but it sounds like it's okay. The way a shipping policy is currently set up, only the first shipping option has the free shipping checkbox. So selecting flat rate and specifying zero for the cost of the second and third option seems to be working for you. However, there is another way, using the same sort of setup with a flat rate shipping policy. And you would then just select standard shipping as the one option and make it free by checking the free shipping box. That way, you can select the standard service that works best for the buyer based on the distance between you and the buyer's location. And because it's free shipping, you can also select the one that isn't as expensive for you. So you make a little dosh on the shipping, and there's nothing wrong with that.
That's a good insight, Griff.
Yeah, I use that word. I have it set up for some items, but not all of them.
Well, our next question was sent to podcast@ebay.com by seller Diana, who wrote, "Hi, love the podcast and all the great information it gives out. I have a question regarding sending offers. I had a situation where a buyer didn't pay. The transaction was auto-canceled after 4 days, and I put the buyer on the blocked buyer list. Within minutes of relisting, it had a watcher and popped up on the send offers to buyers. I would like to make sure that buyers on my blocked buyer list are not eligible to receive offers I send. Thanks in advance for any info you can provide, Diana." Well, Diana, if the buyer is on your blocked buyer list, they cannot purchase from you at all, even if they are watching the item.
That's correct. It's blocked. They could never actually purchase your item. That also means, Diana, that the blocked buyer won't receive any offers if you send it out as a send offers offer, you know, where you can send it to everyone who's watching or has it in their shopping cart. You don't have to worry, and I will spare you my usual screed about using the blocked buyer list.
I have been biting my tongue since I read the words blocked buyer list.
This would not be a reason for me to block a buyer.
Same with me.
I would email them, say, "Hey, was there an issue? Can you tell me about it?" You don't know what might have come up on this one. You're free to do it, of course. Anyone can use the blocked buyer list, but I always say exercise caution.
And the one example I'll use is a long, long time ago, there was a large seller on eBay, and they did not use kind of like the blocked bidder features that we had to kind of remind someone to pay. And they had a blocked bidder, and they'd kind of been tracking him, and they said, "Hey, we want this guy suspended." And so we looked into it. He turned out to be, he didn't buy a fair number of items. He also turned out to be their number one buyer. And the problem was he had only ever bought from that one seller. So he'd never been told, "Hey, you need to really pay for every item." And so he's kept going back to the same seller because he liked the inventory. So all of a sudden we went back to the seller and said, "Are you sure you want us to block someone who 95% of the time is paying and only 5% isn't? And he's your number one buyer by volume in GMV?" And the seller said, "Oh, well, maybe we should use the reminder tool."
Of course, the world is a different place now, and we have that. This is a repeat buyer alert that the seller will know, "Hey, this person's bought from you before." The other thing, you can't do this right now with Best Offer, but soon you will, as we announced in the last update. You can require immediate payment for Best Offers. That's coming soon, as announced, and then that will eliminate this entire process program.
I guess we kind of went on a little, you know, we got our little thing in about blocked buyer list anyway, even though we said we weren't.
Yeah, we're like that. That's because, you know why? Because it's our podcast. We can do what we want. So, neener. Our last question, Brian, is from seller Rick, who wrote to podcast@ebay.com. "Hello, I received the 1099K from eBay. I'm trying to find out how to enter the income I received during 2022 on my current federal tax return. Uh-oh. I use fillable forms to do my taxes online and wonder what form I enter the income. It was only a bit over $600 or so. Please let me know how to enter the income, on what form and on what line. There were no losses, just gain." He says, "I saw this link in the community forum, so I thought I'd give it a shot. Thanks, Rick." And his user ID is Rick Scatz. Well, Rick, we've got some information for you.
We do, Rick. Well, although we cannot give specific tax advice, we can tell you now that there is now an eBay 1099K guide that may help. It's found by going to Seller Hub and clicking on the link on the top of the overview page for Download Form 1099K. The guide is available from that page.
Yeah, and Rick, maybe you want to consider taking advantage of our partnership with TaxAct to get more detailed information about your tax return and how to file. And we'll put the links to both the guide and to the eBay TaxAct splash page in the summary overview for episode 230.
That's good advice.
Yeah, because they can actually show you where on your form you can enter that information. We can't give you that. We can't do that. The terms of our employment with our dear mothership company, eBay, says that no giving out tax advice. And Brian knows, and some of our listener know, that I love giving advice. So it's really
yes,
hard for
do.
Me to bite my tongue on this. I can actually tell you which line to enter it in, but then I won't be on the podcast anymore.
I think you should somehow sneak it into the transcript somewhere, just randomly put the line that it is.
Yeah, and then our eagle-eyed lawyers and legal won't notice it. Think again, Brian. I'm not going to jeopardize our podcast.
And you shouldn't.
But if you want tax advice, just go to TaxAct. Don't email me at griff@ebay.com because I can't give you any.
Oh, come on. Please, someone send in another tax question just so I can see him sweat.
No, no, it's torture.
Well, do you have a question about selling on eBay and you can't find an answer anywhere else?
Well, why not try your last resort? Us!
Exactly. You can call us on 888-723-4630.
That's 888-723-4630. You can call that hotline any time of the day at your convenience. Leave a question or comment. Who knows? If your dulcet tones are dulcet enough, we just might put you on the air.
And if you're a shy person and don't like talking on the phone, you can always email us at podcast@ebay.com. That's podcast@ebay.com.
It's a popular email. It's, you know how much junk mail I'm getting now on that
one? I bet.
Yeah, so you know the spam collectors are listening to the program or somehow getting it, and I'm getting lots of offers to buy products from like China and other countries. So thank you. Thank you very much. But no. Anyway, now, Brian, it's time for their 3-point podcast reminders.
Check the announcement board at ebay.com/announcements for up-to-date seller news every day.
Exactly. And number two, check out the eBay 1099 tax guide we talked about earlier. You can find it on Seller Hub at ebay.com/MES/tax guide.
And we'll put that link in the summary overview for episode 230. And finally, number three, need to review anything in this episode? It's easy. Check the transcript for this and all episodes for follow-up on what you heard and to find the links we referenced during the episode.
And on our next episode, we'll continue with part two with our discussion, Debunking Listing Myths, with our guests Valerie Yee and Ashley Mulder.
And we'd like to again thank Valerie and Ashley for providing their expertise on our topic.
The eBay for Business podcast is produced and distributed by Libsyn and Podcast 411.